This is the Senate Committee on Health Policy. Meeting day is Friday, February 25th, 2005, at 1:30 p.m. We are meeting at the Mount Hood Community College Brooming Center for Allied Health Education in Gresham, Oregon.
I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Health Policy Committee open February 25th, 2005. And I would like to welcome all of you in the audience. It is so wonderful to be able to have our committee meeting here in Gresham, my own district, and I see so many of you who live in my community. So thank you. Thank you to Paula Gubrud and Bob Silverman for letting us be here at the Brooming Center. Center for Allied Health. We'll have a little more information on that. The way the agenda is going to go is we have two bills that we have had in the past that we will be dealing with, and then we will be having some informational meetings on hearing on the nursing shortage, the healthcare workforce shortage. And so that is what the agenda is, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 450. And is there any testimony?
Yes, would you like to explain what we have here?
Okay. Mr. Berkovian, do you want to explain the bill, please?
Thank you, Senator. And just briefly, the committee did hear Senate Bill 450 on the 9th of February. At that time, there was quite a bit of discussion about needing some amendments to clarify circumstances in which a circuit nurse should be present in the surgical room. Attached to your packet are the 450-5 amendments. Basically what these do is, at line 11 and 12 on your bill, inserts language, as you can read on line 5 of the bill, in case you're requiring anesthesia or conscious sedation, circulating nurse shall be assigned to or present in the operating room for the duration of the surgical procedure unless it becomes necessary for the circulating nurse to leave the operating room as part of the procedure. While assigned to a surgical procedure, a circulating nurse may not be assigned to any other patient or procedure. This also should take care of the issue where under the version of the bill, it would prohibit the nurse from ever leaving the room during the duration of the operation. So that's it, Senator.
Okay. Senator Metzger.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Isn't it great to be in beautiful downtown Gresham?
Yeah.
Another 100-year anniversary city. We just celebrated ours in Welch's, so we're kind of tied at the hip between Gresham and Welch's. Well, thank you for the opportunity to come and testify on Senate Bill 450, and I know you heard this bill when my committee was also gone, so I was unable to attend the initial hearing on February 9th, and you bared a lot of the issues. And I would just like to talk about a couple of those and some of the process that you have gone through and commend passage of this bill to you. As you all have understand, the circulating nurse is a really critical part of the operating room. Having been married to someone who is circulating and scrubbed and is now a nurse manager in the operating room, I've heard for many, many years the critical part of standard of care. The circulating nurse is one of the most important parts of the operating room procedure. They maintain the sterile environment, make sure it, that is maintained, make sure that the proper procedures are undertaken, making sure the medical record is correct. In short, making sure that there are no errors in the procedure, which is one of the most important parts, not only for the patient, but certainly for all those involved in the procedure. So this is a very critical position. And while, as was testified by the Hospital Association as I reviewed the record in the previous hearing, that this is the standard of which our hospitals are operating, and it is here in the state of Oregon, this standard of care is, you know, threatened to be eroded elsewhere, and we want to make sure that the standard of care is cemented in Oregon law, and it's important to the health of those who participate in this field and also for our patients. You also heard testimony from a representative from AST representing surgical technologists who pointed out that while the federal standard would allow them to be a circulator, they also pointed out that they believed that was not their proper role, and it was for the registered nurse. Most of the opposition that I heard, interestingly, came from the Oregon Medical Association, which I found rather surprising, because in the 27 other states in which this is in statute, the physicians have been some of the strongest supporters of this legislation, because the physicians are very, very concerned that hospitals provide them with the finest quality of care and personnel to conduct those procedures. So, you know, I thought that was rather interesting. And as I listened to that, it became clear to me that the opposition probably wasn't so much there, but that we are more and more having operating procedures done outside the hospital setting, in ambulatory centers that are physician-owned. And I think therein arises the crux of the issue. But I think it's also very important that the standard of care shouldn't change whether you're in an operating room in a hospital or if you're in a private facility. You have nuanced a lot of this, and I think that shows the due diligence of this committee and listened to all the issues. I do know from sitting on your side there that one, if you don't really want to oppose the bill, you oppose the bill by just wordsmithing every word and talking about this, and so everybody's confused and they hope nothing happens. I think, however, staff and members of the committee have done a good job in really getting to the crux of the issue, and the crux of the issue is standard of care and making sure that we cement that in Oregon law and that patients who visit our hospitals or in operating rooms outside maintain that quality of care. So I commend 450 to you with the Dash 5 amendments. I think you've done a great job in analyzing all these different issues. I think it's very, very important. I know you have eliminated some of the smaller procedures in the operating room. I will also tell you, as I'm sure some of the people behind me in the nursing profession will tell you, they don't think that there should be any exceptions in an operating room setting for not having a circulating nurse. So perhaps in the interest of great legislation, if both parties are a little unhappy with something, then we probably have a pretty good piece of legislation. So thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Questions? Thank you, Senator.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Scott Gallant from the Oregon Medical Association. And if there's anyone else familiar with this bill and you haven't signed up, the sign-up sheet,
well,
we have here, just let us know and we can have you testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to make a few more comments regarding this bill. I don't believe I did, as the previous speaker mentioned. I don't believe I stated that I opposed the bill, but that I thought that it required some refinement. And I appreciate that Mr. Taylor has attempted to do that over the course of the last 10 days or so. As the bill has...
Excuse me, who are you?
I'm sorry, Scott Gallant with the Oregon Medical Association. Thank you, Senator. As the bill has been amended, I understand the Dash 5 amendments, which I don't have, but essentially take out the word general in front of anesthesia, essentially means that in any instance where anesthesia may be provided and a surgical procedure is being performed, whether it is even a topical anesthesia, this bill may, in its literal interpretation, mean that a circulating nurse must be present. What I tried to indicate in previous testimony is that this bill literally says that if a surgical procedure occurs in an ambulatory surgical center, operating room, or a hospital, that a circulating nurse must necessarily be present. My research on this in ambulatory surgical centers referenced by Senator Metzger, those standards are in fact upheld, as I'm sure they are in hospitals. What the bill doesn't do and what it doesn't define clearly is when it is really not necessary for a circulating nurse to be present when minor surgeries are performed, and it would be essentially a added cost for a low benefit in the provision of medical care. I appreciate that it's important for the Oregon Nurses Association to assure that nurses are present in all surgeries, and that there are other standards by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare on who, in fact, would qualify to be a circulating nurse. But I do think it misses some of the subtleties of what actually happens in hospital surgical operating rooms and ambulatory operating rooms today. I appreciate you allowing me to make a few more comments regarding the bill. We'll continue to work on additional amendments to clarify what impact it actually has. Thank you.
The intent of the bill is to minor surgery should not be affected, and so an OR nurse would not need, I mean, a circulating nurse would not to be need to be there. Martin, do you want to come up here just real quick?
Madam Chair, if I may reply. General anesthesia is, in fact, used clearly for serious medical surgical procedures. There are definitions of what that means. That's not provided in the bill, nor is it contemplated in the language itself. And as you are well aware in your profession, there are variations of conscious sedation from serious, from intermediate to low-level conscious sedation. And I'm presuming that the proponents of the bill intend to adopt regulations in regard to what they actually mean in rule, but the bill itself literally says that if there is conscious sedation or the use of anesthesia and there's a surgical procedure performed in an operating room, whether it be a hospital or an ambulatory surgical center, then a circulating nurse must be present.
And I'd like Martin to just comment on that particular issue. Please identify yourself.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor, and I'm here representing the AORN and the Oregon Nurses Association. There is a difficulty in identifying a standard for what procedures do not require a circulating nurse in operating rooms, because nationally, there are many states that don't put a standard in, that say the operating room, by definition, is a place that serious procedures are performed. I think maybe one of the things that has made this a more difficult challenge for Oregon is that it includes ambulatory centers. In an effort to do that, we've taken language that most closely resembles New Mexico, which is one of the few states that separates major and minor procedures, and this is a reflection of what they do. To be honest, if you had left the word general in there, which wasn't our intent, that was something that well-intentioned people were trying to help us clarify the bill and added, but you would eliminate, for example, spinal taps, which are a fairly serious anesthesia. So I'm not a healthcare professional. There will be some who are undoubtedly intending to be here at 1:30 and wandering around Gresham looking for this building, who could give more clarity as to the many procedures requiring anesthesia that need to be covered by this bill that the word general anesthesia did not cover. But we're very confident that this is language that sets Oregon apart from other states by giving more discretion to individual hospitals or ambulatory centers to not perform some minor procedures in their facility, that we will have one of the least restrictive laws of its kind. And all my folks are happy about it, but I think that in the spirit of trying to find a compromise and to cover surgical centers where that hasn't been done in other places, we're willing to set that line.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah. So a spinal tap would not be covered under conscious sedation? You're conscious. I mean, that's the point of it.
Again, not being a healthcare professional and having folks coming in to have my back, according to my boss, Susan King, I will cite my source, who is an RN who works in this, that a spinal block would not be, in fact, covered by the statute if the word general anesthesia was there. So If you need greater clarity, there are folks who do this for a living who will be here as soon as they can find this peculiar part of Gresham. But I would report to you that my nurses assure me that the word general in front of the word anesthesia limits the bill too much and has unprotected procedures that should really have an RN circulator there.
Well, follow-up, Madam Chair. I support the intent of the bill, but and maybe we can get some certified smart people on this, because I'm not a healthcare professional either. Just playing it on TV, I guess. But it seems to me that you know, you say putting general there makes it too restrictive. Maybe not having it there makes it too broad. So I'm not sure we've necessarily found the nexus yet.
Our position is that the operating room is for serious procedures, and what you're doing, really, if I may address this, is we have not heard testimony from anyone who runs operating rooms or surgical centers that they're not using RN circulators. We have an email anecdote from the Hospital Association of a hospital that sometimes allows their providers to use their operating room for minor procedures, and that's it. So a little of this is legislation by anecdote for saying, while many other states have adopted a standard that all procedures need to have an RN circulator, in Oregon we're going to make an exception to that standard based on what has really been very little testimony. And we've been comfortable going along with that because we want to find a bill that everyone can agree to, but it becomes a little bit of a what-if game for us. At some point you have to say, look, the operating room is is by definition a place where serious procedures are done. If we're going to draw an exception, we need to make sure that it's an exception that it puts patient safety as a priority. And that's what we think these amendments do.
And Martin, I agree with that. But, and this is anecdotal too, but some A and B hospitals that are struggling even to survive and are having staffing problems and do use their facilities for major surgeries as well as minor procedures because it's all they have, I don't want to put them in a box that we don't intend to put them in, and that's my fear with this. So, which is why the words are important and the definitions are important, so that we protect appropriate health care in remote parts of Oregon where that's the only place they have to go. So,
I mean, of course, it's always the ally position of a lobbyist. I've made your same argument back to my membership who aren't entirely comfortable with that, and without ever really getting comfortable, they've said, okay, well, if you're going to do that, then here's a line that. It's now reflected in this amendment.
Okay.
I think that even in those small facilities, there are folks that believe that there's some doctor's office available to do a minor procedure, and that it's really for convenience sake they're doing it in the operating room.
Okay. Any further discussion? Scott, do you have any?
Just the actual language from New Mexico, which Mr. Taylor was happy to provide a couple weeks ago. Referred to hospitals. A qualified health professional registered nurse shall function as circulating nurse in the surgical and obstetrical room whenever general anesthesia is used, and on all local anesthesia cases involving high degree of patient risk. Individual surgical technologists and licensed practical nurses may function as assistants under the direct supervision of a qualified professional registered nurse. Just thought that'd be appropriate to put on the record. And again, I really do appreciate you taking the time to consider my comments.
What you just stated, Mr. Gallen, is definitely the intent of this bill. And I want that to be on the record. And if there needs to be, I really would like to move it. But let's then have Joe Bell come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon. I'm Joe Bell with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I just wanted to briefly testify to the Dash 5 amendments. in discussions with Mr. Taylor just before the meeting, I think that we are okay with the amendment, with the understanding that he is talking about the operating rooms, and there are some concerns still with the small facilities, but I think that we need to clarify those a little bit. The one area that we still have concern with is, from a number of our more larger facilities, is the duration of the surgical procedure, and I'm hearing from them, you know, one of them defines it as when they're in the operating room, one of them defines it from the time they get to pre-op until they're out of post-op. So I think that's an area maybe that needs some little work. And that while we support the intent of this bill, because our hospitals are all using circulating nurses, we also don't know if the standards of care need to be legislated. But those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morton.
Scott Gallant raised an interesting point, that New Mexico statute in small hospitals where nurses are not available to circulate, will we allow surgical technicians to take their place in this bill?
My reading of the bill, Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Morissette, is that it would not. And it is not my understanding from the small facilities that have reported to me that they, in fact, do that. They do, in fact, use a circulating nurse.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because the New Mexico language did allow for that, which was interesting.
Other than what was read into the record, I haven't read the New Mexico law, so I'd have to look at that to see if I think it makes a difference.
Okay. Thank you. All right, I need to know how the committee feels about this. Okay. I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 450, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 450. Senator Cruz?
I move the Dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 450.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 5 amendments. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered, the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 450 have been adopted. Is there a motion to adopt the Senate Bill 450 as?
Sure.
Oh.
Bang it. Yeah.
As. Okay. Don't know when to use this yet.
just going to use it on the end, we'll be done. Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
I move Senate Bill 450 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz has moved Senate Bill 450 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
I think there's some validity in what Mr. Gallant talked about, and for the record, I would like for that to be further looked at when this bill gets to the House, and maybe there's a way we can be a little more clear on getting to. I support the bill. I support what it's after. I just want to make sure we don't have unintended consequences by moving this measure.
All right. Any other further hearing? No further discussion? All those of the opinion that Senate Bill 450 as amended with the Dash 1 amendments, Dash 5 amendments with a recommendation of due pass, answer aye as your name is called. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator George?
Excused.
Chair Montanison?
Aye. Motion carries. And I think I will carry this bill. I think
that's appropriate.
The nurse. In case there's some nursey questions. Okay, I'd like to close the work session on Senate Bill 450, and I'd like to open a work session on I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 460. And Martin Taylor from the Oregon Nurses Association. Well, first, Mr. Berkobin, do you want to describe the bill?
Just briefly, Senator, and it probably would be apropos since we did hear this bill also. on 220 or a couple weeks ago. There were some substantial amendments to this bill, basically, for the most part, gotten stuff, and we just got them late, so I'm going to defer to the Mr. Taylor to kind of walk through the Dash 1 amendments, which should be in your stack. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Martin Taylor with the Oregon Nurses Association, and with your permission, I'd like to have my colleague Sue Davidson from the Oregon Nurses Association join me. Is that okay?
Madam Chair, just before we start, basically the amendment was supposed to put back in the language that was, that's what it does?
It does.
Okay, then I can listen with comfort.
In the 2003 legislative session, this bill and its companion for nurse practitioners, Senate Bill 708, were both worked over quite thoroughly in the House side. We worked closely with the Pharmacist Association on a series of compromises that led to the pharmacist taking a neutral position. And when the bill was initially drafted, it didn't reflect all of those agreements, but it was our intent that they would. So we now have a version of the bill in 460-3, which I think you will find the pharmacists are comfortable with, as we are.
Dash one.
Sorry, dash one?
Dash one, yes. I hope so. That's what we have.
We don't have dash three.
Oh, is there a dash three?
Well,
you're off of threes?
I'm off of threes.
We never got the threes.
Oh, okay. Oh, there's one.
I slipped these threes into your door.
Okay.
In the public hearing on Senate Bill 460, and we now have the dash three amendments ahead of us, in front of us. Could you please describe what they do?
Yes. I'm assuming I don't need to introduce myself again. So it's Martin Taylor from ONA. This is a gut and stuff to return us to legislation that was known as 709 last session, and most of the work that went into this that has now been added back in are agreements made with the pharmacists, although I should mention that there were also negotiations with LMA at the time. So some of those are things that LMA wanted, although they never last session agreed to support the bill. It would require that a clinical nurse specialist, it gives them the privilege of writing prescriptions. That's actually not new from the previous bill. It would allow them to dispense medications to patients under emergency or who had access issues. But those access issues will be defined as either geographic or economic access issues. They have to have completed a prescription drug dispensing program in order to earn the authority to do dispensing, so it's not given to every clinical nurse specialist. In order to demonstrate an access issue, there are standards given, such as access to pharmacy services, evidence that a patient has an economic barrier, distance from a metropolitan site. It also requires that dispensers, in this case CNSs, clinical nurse specialists, have the same record keeping requirements that other dispensers would have, that they have the same labeling requirements that other dispensers would have, that they're working off of, that they have the ability to dispense prepackaged manufactured drugs, which, if you need a better explanation of that, I have the expert with me, and that they also have the same electronic references working that are commonly used by other dispensers. In other words, these amendments put into statute parallel language that is required for nurse practitioners. I guess my only comment after that is that while these were hard-fought amendments that came out of the last legislative session, this will make both nurse practitioners and clinical nurse specialists the most restricted dispensers of medication that you have in statute, but the concern that this bill is attempting to address are folks who, either because of an income problem or an access problem, are using their advanced practice nurse as their primary provider, and it is a difficulty, a hardship for them to get their medication dispensed in another place, so we're willing to live with that.
Mr. Reed, pardon my fault.
Okay, we're having a problem.
Oh.
The only difference between the dash ones and the dash threes is on the last page of the dash threes and the dash ones, and it looks like the dash threes are deleting page two when it really should be page four. On page four, if we delete lines 1 through 28 as the dash 3 say, it says you do that on page 2.
That should be 4. Yes, that's a very good catch. I have expert counsel up there. You are, in fact, if that amendment is taken as page 2, deleting the wrong section of the original bill.
And the dash 1s is exactly this. Let's see. The dash ones have it correct. On page four, you delete lines 1 through 28.
I must admit that I wasn't able to explain that difference.
Okay, and the dash threes, the only difference was what was on the difference on page two and
right.
page four, and then for some reason, even the dash threes left out the word clinical on clinical nurse specialists. On the dash threes, it just lists it as nurse specialists.
Have the same electronic references working that are commonly used by other dispensers. In other words, these amendments put into statute parallel language that is required for nurse practitioners. I guess my only comment after that is that while these were hard-fought amendments that came out of the last legislative session, this will make both nurse practitioners and clinical nurse specialists the most restricted dispensers of medication that you have in statute, but the concern that this bill is attempting to address are folks who, either because of an income problem or an access problem, are using their advanced practice nurse as their primary provider, and it is a difficulty, a hardship for them to get their medication dispensed in another place, so we're willing to live with that.
Okay, we're having a problem.
Oh.
The only difference between the dash ones and the dash threes is on the last page of the dash threes and the dash ones, and it looks like the dash threes are deleting page two when it really should be page four. On page four, if we delete lines 1 through 28 as the dash threes say, it says you do that on page two.
That should be four. Yes, that's a very good catch. I have expert counsel up there. You are, in fact, if that amendment is taken as page two, deleting the wrong section of the original bill.
And the dash ones is exactly this. Let's see. The dash ones have it correct. On page four, you delete lines 1 through 28.
I must admit that I wasn't able to explain that difference.
Okay, and the dash threes, the only difference was what was on the difference on page two and
right.
page four, and then for some reason, even the dash threes left out the word clinical on clinical nurse specialists. On the dash threes, it just lists it as nurse specialist.
You have the advantage on me. I never saw dash one or dash two, so even now you have paper in front of you, I don't.
Madam Chair.
I think the dash ones are exactly what we want.
We have to do page to 29, not 28. We delete 28. It'll still. I said delete 28. We have to delete the chair on.
Oh. And that's on paper. Yeah.
So.
Senator Courtney.
Mr. Chair, you never saw the dash one amendments?
No, the amendments that I got from council were dash threes, which, you know, there was a lot of work being done very quickly on this, and Rick Rakobian was a very helpful point person on that, but I saw what I thought we needed to at the end.
Really, the dash ones are...
Do you mind if we just stand at each other and have a chance to look them over?
Yes, we're standing at ease again. the hearing on Senate Bill 460, the dash ones evidently just had omitted one word, certified clinical nurse specialist. And Tom Holt, do you want to come up? And I don't want to waste any more time on this. This is wordsmithing something.
What she meant to say was she doesn't want to take any more time on this.
For the record, I'm Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. I appreciate Mr. Taylor working with us on these amendments. And the dash one amendments with that Scrivener's correction of adding certified on the last page there do reflect the agreement we've made that essentially what the amendments do is restore all the language in the original bill in Section 6 that would have been otherwise deleted, and that reflects the agreements we've had for some time on this subject.
Okay. Sure. All right. Is there any further discussion? All right. For the record, the dash one amendments on page 3, line 7, have the word certified submitted just after the word or and just before the word clinical.
Well, that's not true. But no, if you're going off the three,
yep.
You've got to add the certified clinical.
Yep.
But we have to go under what group?
Oh, under three?
Uh-oh.
No.
No.
On the dash ones. I'm sorry. Dash ones are the ones that we have to work with.
Okay.
All right.
We're
going to
put certified
before clinical. Okay. Yes, the dash one.
Okay.
So I'm going to, if there's no further discussion, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 460, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 460.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 460. Well, we have to have it in play to correct it, I believe.
Okay.
Okay, let's do it this way. I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 460, correcting the Scribner's error on page 3, line 7 of the amendment by inserting the word
certified
in between the words or and clinical.
Any discussion?
There's a little bit of discussion here, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
I think I'm going to go along with this, but I must tell you, I desperately wish legislative counsel is here because I don't know whether I'm getting myself in any trouble as a presiding officer allowing this is a conceptual amendment this early on, I'm just going to tell you. So I'm going to go along, but I'm just a little tense at this stage of the game. Not to the intent. I'm not having a problem with the intent. It's just a process thing that has me a bit nervous, but I'm going to go along with this. I'll just put it that way. I just want to move for the record, too.
It was a typo omission. Rather than, it's really not a conceptual amendment because we're not changing anything. A word was left out.
But we haven't heard from Judy Hall yet, so.
Thank you. That's
all right.
That's perfect.
Okay, any further discussion? Any opposition to adopting the dash one amendment? So ordered. No.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
I move Senate Bill 460 as amended to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 460 as amended to the floor with a do pass in recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? clerk call the roll?
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator George?
Excuse.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Metzger? Sorry, what is that?
They look a lot alike.
Aye.
And Chair Monson?
Aye. Motion carries. And is there someone who would like to carry this?
Okay.
All right, Senator Cruz will carry this bill on the floor. All right. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 460. And now comes the most exciting part of the whole day. And I'm going to open an informational hearing. And we have some invited testimony, and I'd like to start with Molly Moore and Joe Bell. The nursing shortage has been an extremely important issue in the state of Oregon. Here we have one of the highest unemployment in the nation, and yet we have a critical nursing shortage. And I know that the nursing associations, the private and public universities and community colleges, the leadership in all of those agencies have been working hard to address this issue. And we are now going to be bringing you, committee, up to date regarding the Oregon healthcare workforce shortage. And take it away. Please introduce yourselves.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Molly Moore with the Governor's Office of Education and Workforce Policy and the Governor's Healthcare Workforce Initiative Coordinator.
Thank you.
And good afternoon again. I'm Jill Bell, and I'm with the Director of Legislative Support Services for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I would like to start out today by sort of setting the stage for a presentation. It is not our intention to bring to you all of the individual activities that are going on around the state. There are just all kinds of things going on with local partnerships to address the healthcare workforce shortages. But our intention here today is really to highlight some of the major statewide initiatives. All of us are now familiar with the reasons for the looming healthcare shortage. We have an aging baby boomer population, and that is affecting our workforce in the healthcare industry. And that also means that it's a double whammy for healthcare, because that means we have more aging people and therefore more demand for the healthcare system. In addition, we are also now aware of the barriers to easily adding students to the pipeline. Those are listed both on the screen and in your handout, and they are, I think, fairly well known by everyone at this point. Once the crisis was identified, these organizations in this first circle were sort of the first responders, and they responded by doing reports and studies to sort of determine what the shortages were. And I'm going to tell you, I understand that there are all kinds of issues with acronyms in the building, and we're not supposed to be using those. So rather than going through each one of these slides and outlining what all the acronyms are, we've provided you with this orange piece that has not only the what the acronym stands for, but what that organization is doing or has done to work on the healthcare workforce initiative. Once these first responders had done their reports, individual healthcare and education organizations around the state began to look at and develop their own plans and programs in their own area. And also state government took note and wrote two reports. One is referred to as the Taking Aim Report, which came out of the governor's Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and another one was House Bill 3353 Legislative Task Force. That House Bill 3353 was passed in 2001, and the report was presented to the legislature last year. Despite all of this activity in this sort of third ring of the healthcare vortex, each sector was sort of focused on doing their own things, and they were all focused very locally, and very little of the response was coordinated or even considered on a statewide basis. At the center of the crisis, and as we move outward, what we've discovered is that we've created an unmistakable synergy in Oregon. The activity of individual organizations and local coalitions have coalesced coalesced into an awareness that we didn't have the time or the resources to continue to recreate the same solutions all around the state. So an awareness has developed that we must look at everything from a statewide perspective and act together to solve the crisis. So we have public and private sector, healthcare industry, and all the education community are now working on these efforts. One of the major needs identified has been an issue around the statewide telecommunications capacity. Both the Taking Aim report and the House Bill 3353 legislative report suggested this was an issue. So last session, the legislature passed House Bill 2577, and they directed the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council to collaborate with the state education providers and healthcare industry to develop a plan to ensure that the telecommunications infrastructure was available to provide healthcare workforce education via distance and e-learning modalities. They have done and are continuing to do an inventory of telecommunications networks in healthcare, K-12, community colleges, higher ed, and government. And their goal is not to create a new network to address healthcare workforce education, but to connect the links between these various existing networks so that we have the infrastructure necessary to provide both telecommunications education as well as telehealth services. Secondly, another subcommittee of the ORTCC has looked especially at what is needed to provide distance and e-learning, not the technology piece, but what other supports are needed. And they have developed specific recommendations that indicate to stakeholders such as the legislature, the boards of higher ed, the healthcare industry itself, and even the students what is required of them to make distance and e-learning work in the state. And I believe that that group will be providing a presentation on the report to this committee at some point. Another one of the statewide activities that is going on, and probably the first one that really got off the ground, is called the Community College Healthcare Action Plan, or CCHAP. And it's a statewide effort of all the 17 community colleges. It is a 3 to 5 year initiative, and they're going to be coordinating their efforts to develop healthcare capacity, to have collaborations between their local community colleges and their healthcare institutions in the community. And also they are going to work with K-12 and four-year schools and the communities generally around the state. A couple of their projects include an effort to build a common student learning outcomes in anatomy and physiology. One of the identified barriers to getting students through the system has been the lack of consistency between prerequisites. And what that creates is the issue of non-transferability for students, so that if they start in one institution, they cannot continue. They have to go to another institution and take A&P all over again. So they are looking at student learning outcomes. And then another very popular project with the community colleges and their local healthcare providers has been a resource guide or handbook, which outlines all of the grant opportunities specific to healthcare workforce education. They have provided this both online and through GIS. And they're right now in the process of updating that because they've had so much good response on it. It has also helped because a lot of times the individuals working on these are not grant writers, so they've indicated they have a section on how to actually work on grants.
Does the Community College Healthcare Action Plan meet on a regular basis?
Actually, it is set up of a number of contracted individuals who work on a specific they actually meet weekly, and they each have their own projects that they work on. Then they have a steering committee that meets quarterly to sort of direct their efforts. And they also do regular reports to, I believe, the President's Council of the Community Colleges.
Thank you.
And then also the Oregon University System, as part of their Academic Excellence and Economic Development Work Group that they formed in the past couple of years, they established a medical personnel subcommittee to review what OUS is doing as a group. And I might add that one of the handouts that you received is
some testimony from Denise Hansel, who is the new director for the OIT Center for Health Professions, and they are actually carrying on a lot of the work that was developed by the AEED committee. All of these complement the efforts that Molly is going to talk about around what the governor is doing and a couple of the other major statewide initiatives.
Thank you. So as you've heard from Joe, and you're all aware, there are many, many barriers to the health.
Could you introduce yourself?
Oh, sorry. Once again, members of the committee, Madam Chair, Molly Moore with the Governor's Healthcare Workforce Initiative Coordinator. As I was saying, there's many barriers to the healthcare workforce shortage issue, and it's extremely complex in terms of addressing it. But what I wanted to do was kind of provide you a little bit of an overview of what the governor's office is doing to address these with their partners. And in the last session, as Joe mentioned, your great work helped to identify the crisis situation here, and then our governor now asked staff to put a program together to address healthcare workforce shortage issues, and the governor's healthcare workforce initiative was created a little over a year ago. The vision overall of the initiative is to dramatically increase the quality and quantity of the healthcare workforce, thus addressing patient safety issues, as well as expediting the training of students and putting them through the system faster. The project fits with the governor's overall vision to and policy objective to stimulate economic growth through investments in healthcare workforce and education. I'm really happy to be presenting with Joe Bell today because I really want to emphasize the fact that this is truly a public-private partnership, this initiative is. We have an advisory committee that helps to direct the effort, and Chair Monis Anderson sits on the advisory committee with Senator Nelson, as well as Representative Flores. In addition to that, we have Joe Bell representing industry and other folks representing industry as well. We have community colleges represented, the university system represented. We have folks from labor. In addition, we have our entire WorkSource Oregon system from Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, the DHS, as well as Employment Department. In addition to directing this initiative, the advisory committee is helping to support Senate Bill 882, which is sponsored by Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Nelson and Representative Flores. The bill directs the employment partner in consultation and partnership with the healthcare industry to do a statewide needs assessment of healthcare workforce needs and thus directing the programs of the healthcare workforce education system. So we, with regards to this initiative, I'll just go through some of these very quickly, but we did raise $1 million for the initiative. I'll talk about where we're putting that money. First, most of this funding has come from the federal government, the Department of Labor, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which is federal dollars, DHS through Homeland Security dollars, and that we also received money from the Northwest Health Foundation. And first of all, I want to talk about the simulation alliance that we've created. And here we are today in the Bruning Center, and one of our members of the Simulation Alliance, and one of the, you know, obviously a great representation of that. So I'm very excited that we're here today. So the overall mission of the Oregon Simulation Alliance is to utilize high-tech, high-fidelity simulation, which you all got to see an example of, to expedite the training of the healthcare workforce. And as you saw today, we can simulate different scenarios, the consequences of smoking, for example, as you saw, but in addition to that, we can simulate heart attacks, we can simulate strokes, there's even birthing models. So it's truly extraordinary high technology that we're looking at using here. One of our biggest barriers to the healthcare shortage is the lack of clinical facilities across the state, and simulation can actually help to supplement those clinical hours and in some places actually replace those clinical hours, thus expediting those students through the system. The second one, Joe already addressed the telecommunications capacity, and we fully support the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council. The only thing I wanted to state there is that if we had, our goal is to have all the simulation centers be connected via two-way video, two-way audio to really expedite this network of simulation centers across the state.
Does it have to be broadband or with the new technology? Will wireless ever be able to be used eventually, or does it all have to be broadband right now?
Well, I'm not a technical expert, but my understanding, Senator Montes Anderson, is that at this point it does need to be broadband.
That's the there's nods in the audience,
yeah.
Too.
Okay. Good. So the third element is increasing the number of healthcare faculty, and this most of our efforts have really been around simulation up to this point to really get it up and running. We haven't done a ton of work in this element, but certainly a full implementation of the simulation network and broadband capabilities will help to impact those faculty shortages. Fourth area is encouraging regulatory flexibility. We're charged our advisory committee to really look at what areas we could potentially tweak regulatory issues and bodies that might need, and we're just looking at those now as well. The fifth one is supporting workplace and practice environment incentives that promote retention of practitioners in patient care. And again, a very new element that we're just beginning to take a look at. The sixth one you're going to hear more about today, we really want to promote common student learning outcomes, and the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education is a great example of something that does that, and I'm excited for you to hear about that. We fully support their efforts. And then Joe also mentioned the efforts around CCHAP that is looking at the A&P articulation issues. So now I just wanted to get a little more, give you a little more information about the Simulation Alliance and get a little more in-depth. As I mentioned, we raised $1 million for this initiative. And in order to best leverage our money, we went around the state to 17 different sites to help to create what we call coalitions in local areas. And these coalitions were made up of healthcare providers in their areas, education providers, public safety with regards to fire and police, sometimes K-12, and many others. They all look a little bit different, but the goal is to really leverage the money, because what we did with the money was provide funding to purchase simulation equipment such as what you saw here today. And so obviously we couldn't give money to every healthcare provider that wanted one, so we really helped folks to figure out how they could work together to really leverage this funding, to help them to build advisory committees and business plans to respond to an RFP that we put out on the street. And we ended up giving equipment funding to 14 locations across the state. And now what we're using the money for is to really begin to build that network, help them to just share best practices, support the Simulation Alliance, helping them to build these scenarios like you saw today. How can we get them to share all their information and best practices that they're learning? We're also going to be, starting next month, going to initiate a training of trainers. So we're going to train up to 60 people across the state to become educators on this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
How much one of those labs cost? The equipment.
Well,
the building.
What we did, we capped our, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, we capped our dollar amount that we gave to these folks at $50,000. And one of them cost anywhere between baseline of $24,000, and depending on what you've added to that, it could go up to $50,000. So as you saw today, one of our great simulation facilities here, what you're seeing is that we gave this small amount of money, really, and you look at this facility and you see additional equipment, you see additional faculty, and you see the space that they've provided. And many of the other simulation centers across the state look very similar. Some of them have mobile labs and those kinds of things, but the point is that we're truly leveraging this money to the extent possible. There's no national model to follow here. We're really breaking ground. People are really looking to us and getting phone calls from folks about how are we doing what we're doing. So I'm just very excited about the progress that we've made, and just very quickly wanted to tell you a little bit about some of the plans and what our products and services are for the Simulation Alliance. I've covered most of them, really being a network of information and best practices, putting up a website, starting to implement summits that folks can come to and share information. We also want to be a conduit for leverage funding. As I said, we raised $1 million, but we're actively pursuing additional funding from the federal government. We have an appropriations request in for $1.8 million, of which the governor has identified this as one of his top priorities to be funded. So we're making progress, but this is certainly an evolution. The Simulation Alliance and the Governor's Healthcare Workforce Initiative is a great example of how we can leverage partnerships and resources to make progress. A year ago, there were only 3 simulators in the state, and now we're on track to have 20 across the state. And we recognize there's a lot more to do, but we're proud of the progress, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Molly, does the governor's office, do you have the numbers of people who are waiting to get into nursing programs in the state of Oregon? We have great programs, but unfortunately they're limited. They have limited access. Do you have those figures?
Senator Morissette, Madam Chair, I don't have those figures on me. Joe, do you have any?
I've asked before for the figures, and I'm kind of curious about who has.
I just happen to have them on me.
Oh, good.
OHSU sent me their figures, and I know they had over 800 applications, and they only admitted 264.
Okay, but that's OHSU. I'm talking about.
And Portland Community College had 800 applications and 90 accepted.
That's only part of the state, though.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the entire state of Oregon. I'd like to know how many people we are turning away from programs that we desperately need.
Yeah. Chairman Sanderson and Senator Morissette, we do have, there is one issue with collecting that data, and what the issue is that we don't have any centralized way of knowing how many different places these students apply.
Okay.
We know that they're applying to multiple places. I can say, though, that I believe almost every program has the situation where they have many more students applying than they can.
May I follow up? I guess I would like to know each. You know, community colleges offer programs, most of them, I imagine. I would really like to find a figure that we can work from, because I don't know that people understand the magnitude of the problem. It's a nationwide problem, and if we want to do something about it, we have to really understand it. These are family wage jobs, and there are openings for them. People are leaving hospitals. Nurses are leaving hospitals because of the strain, the overtime. I understand there's a problem with faculty members to teach nurses, but unless we understand the magnitude, we're never even going to begin to solve it. So I think we need to do that.
Madam Chair, somebody.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Molly, does the governor's office, do you have the numbers of people who are waiting to get into nursing programs in the state of Oregon? We have great programs, but unfortunately, they're limited. They have limited access. Do you have those figures?
Senator Morissette, Madam Chair, I don't have those figures on me. Joe, do you have the...
Okay. I've asked before for other figures, and I'm kind of curious about
I just happen to have them on me. OHSU sent me their figures, and I know they had over 800 applications, and they only admitted 264.
Okay, but that's OHSU.
Portland Community College had 800 applications and 90 accepted.
That's only part of the state, though.
Yes.
I'm talking about the entire state of Oregon. I'd like to know how many people we are turning away from programs that we desperately need.
Chairman Sanderson and Senator Morissette, we do have, there is one issue with collecting that data, and what the issue is that we don't have any centralized way of knowing how many different places these students apply. We know that they're applying to multiple places. I can say, though, that I believe almost every program has the situation where they have many more students applying than they can.
May I follow up? Yeah, I guess I would like to know each... You know, community colleges offer programs, most of them, I imagine. I would really like to find a figure that we can work from, because I don't know that people understand the magnitude of the problem. It's a nationwide problem, and if we want to do something about it, we have to really understand it. These are family wage jobs, and there are openings for them. People are leaving hospitals, nurses are leaving hospitals because of the strain, the overtime. I understand there's a problem with faculty members to teach nurses, but unless we understand the magnitude, we're never even going to begin to solve it. So I think we need to do that.
Madam Chair, somebody towards the back of the room said 401, but I think that may be low. Oh, four applicants for every one position statewide. Okay.
Okay.
Is that helpful at all?
Well, I'd still like to have how many thousand people in Oregon are trying to get into a program that we have limited. That would be good information if we're trying to solve the problem, I think.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that speaks to another issue, and that's coordination of information, which Joe spoke to. So.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. I now would like to call
coming in for a resource, I think.
Resource?
It is ironic because, you know, Kristen Campbell today.
Oh, Kristen Campbell. Yeah.
I'm Lee Shores, Project Director for the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education.
I misplaced the...
Dr. Campbell is next on your agenda.
Yeah, that's what we're looking for. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Chris Campbell, the Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Nursing. It is my pleasure to be here to talk to you about the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council and the Oregon Center for Nursing. I will first start with explaining our organizations and then tell you some of the successes since we have organized, and then what still needs to be done for the state of Oregon. And you have already brought up many of those issues already today.
Senator Courtney?
Dr. Campbell, in a few minutes, I'm going to have to leave to go back to Salem for an event I have to participate in, so please don't. I don't want you to feel like I'm being rude, so I do need to do that. So I want to apologize in advance, okay? So I just thought I should do that.
Thank you. And I am in your folders on the right-hand side are the slides that I'm using. I have also included a one-page fact sheet about the Oregon Center for Nursing, and I have a five-page one if you would like it. So I'll be happy to get that to you if you would like. And I've also given you a copy of our calendar for this year, and you can write on July 22nd, which is a Play for Oregon's Health, our major fundraiser for the Oregon Center for Nursing, on your nice new calendars, showcasing Oregon nurses and Oregon nursing. I need to go back one here. So let me tell you about the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council. Several years ago, when it became widely known that there was a huge nursing shortage, not only nationally, but certainly in Oregon as well, the nursing leadership in Oregon came together and formed the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council to be part of the solution to the nursing shortage. The Leadership Council is comprised of three members of the five major nursing leadership organizations in Oregon. Northwest Organization is Nurse Executives. The Oregon Council of Associate Degree Programs, those are directors of the Associate Degree of the Community College Nursing Programs. Oregon Council of Deans, those are our deans of the Baccalaureate and Higher Nursing Programs. Oregon Nurses Association, which is our labor, and Oregon State Board of Nursing, which is our regulatory organization. Their strategic goals at that time, and there have been some revisions, but we're still working on these, was to double enrollment in Oregon nursing programs by 2004, and I will tell you where we are with that, to develop, implement, and evaluate staffing models that make the best use of available nursing workforce, to redesign nursing education to meet more directly the changing healthcare needs of Oregonians, and you're going to hear about that when Dr. Tanner talks about the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education. Recruit and retain nurses in the profession, and to create the Oregon Center for Nursing to coordinate implementation and ongoing evaluation of the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council strategic plan. We are the executive arm. We can do the, help them do their work. So the Oregon Center for Nursing then was created in 2002 to help implement that plan. We are a 501c3 organization, nonprofit, primarily funded initially by, we've had generous support from the Northwest Health Foundation. We also had a rural health grant from Senator Smith. And now we're looking for sustainable funding. Our board of directors, my board of directors, is one member each from the five nursing leadership organizations that were described. And I'm an ex-officio member of the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council. The mission is to advance evidence-based decisions about nursing workforce and recruitment and the retention of nurses in Oregon. We are a nursing workforce center. The Oregon Center for Nursing is. There are 37 in the United States at various levels of development, and they operate in different ways. We are one of few, actually, that are controlled by nursing, that are created by nursing and controlled by nursing, some work for, and we're fortunate in that we're not working for any particular organization. And our motto is, because Oregon's health depends on it. Our successes, I think we've talked about collaboration a couple times today already. The fact that we have a united, visionary voice for nursing to solve the problems of the future shortage in Oregon is remarkable. People have come to the table, put aside personal differences, and tried to create a plan that would help the health of Oregonians in the long run. It's a national model for leadership, collaboration, and communication. We've been able to increase the visibility of the profession of nursing, which is something we cannot let up on. We know that there are lots of students applying, and Senator Moore said, we don't know how many we are really turning away because it's hard to capture that data. But that is something that we are trying to do, and we would love to do a study to work with different admissions organizations or the admissions departments to figure out how many students actually do get in or be turned away because five schools may be turning away the same student, and that student could be getting in somewhere. So we don't know that information yet. Recruitment campaign to target males and ethnic minorities, as well as smart, science-based students. We need smart men and women in nursing. You may have seen some of these posters. Are You Man Enough to Be a Nurse? Was created by the Center for Nursing. We've won the national awards and have put Oregon on the map with this poster. And we believe it's working, so we'll have to gather our data to show that. But we have sold the rights to this, and this has shown up in Virginia, and it's also been in Sports Illustrated. And here we are out in the ball fields in Virginia. So we're making headway with that. And as I said, we have won quite a number of awards with this poster, and we continue to sell them on a weekly basis as part of our fundraising. To help recruit minority students, we created this poster in 2004, Caring Knows No Boundaries, All Oregon Nurses. The Oregon Center for Nursing, this is our website, and you can find out about a career in nursing or funding for education, and there's a lot of information on the nursing shortage and recruitment, and we are in the process of having this developed with support from the Northwest Health Foundation and volunteer time from Bernard Hodes. We're doing that, and actually many of the pictures that are in the calendar that I gave you, you will be seeing that will be the look at the website. We are trying to recruit young people because, you know, we have to start younger than high school to plant the seeds of nursing. So we've had a partnership with Saturday Academy. We've done a Nursing is Cool class. Men in Scrubs has been really popular. Adventures in Nursing was a three-day camp that was a collaborative effort that actually got featured on the Today Show. These are some of our students learning how to intubate in Men in Scrubs. Other successes, we came together at the very beginning to magnetize the state of Oregon, meaning using the best practices for keeping nurses, because we know that the best nursing practices have the best patient outcomes. So, and to advance education reform, and you'll hear a lot about the educational goals. We've had great achievement toward the educational goals and significant increases in enrollment in the nursing schools, but we're not there yet. You can see here, and it's not real easy to see, but the green line shows you from 2001, which is
here. From 2001 to 2005, we have increased enrollment. This actually is graduation data from the state board, and this is telling us that we have graduated about 11% more nurses per year since 2001. So to double enrollment by 2004, we're at about 45% of that. This is recent data from a study that we are in process of writing up right now in Oregon workforce data. According to our projections, and the projections, this is information also that we got from the educators, because we queried all the educators. We expect that we will have doubled enrollment by 2007. Yes.
I need a more step. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, you said something very interesting earlier about enrollment. A nurse may apply to four or five different institutions, and if you count a turn, how many people apply, you might be double or triple or quadrupling the number by not knowing. That's a good point.
Those are applications.
Yeah.
We were looking at enrollment, so how many actually get in, and these data are showing how many graduates we've had. So who do we really get through the system? The next piece is to look at licensure. But this is the information we got from the educators. So we're about halfway there, which is huge. University of Portland has doubled. Oregon Health Sciences University has almost doubled enrollment. That's a tremendous effort. And I believe a real success story. Other things we've done, we heard about the Simulation Laboratory Initiative. That's not ours, but we've been in full support and participatory. And many of the ONLC members are on those committees. University of Portland and OHSU are promoting faculty as a career, a faculty choice as a career. As you heard the, or as you alluded to earlier, there's a shortage of faculty, and the faculty are on average older than the average nurse, and I have a slide about how old we are. So that's, we have to have faculty in order to increase the work with the simulation. You can train more with equipment, but we still need nursing faculty. So they've done a good job trying to promote that as a career choice. We've also a huge collaborative effort between schools and healthcare facilities has been the Regional Clinical Nurse Placement Work Group. This is in support of increasing the capacity to teach nurses by coming, and this is to teach nurses in the clinical setting. So we can use the simulation alliance, we can, and this, previous programs are about 5 in the country so far that have done something similar to this. We've also created a software program with support from the Southwest Washington Workforce Development Council because we include Southwest Washington. And we can increase clinical placement by about 25%. I believe this particular initiative will have far greater second and third order effects other than just getting increased capacity because we have everybody at the table talking about solving problems. So I think we'll see more collaboration in the future from this group. Oregon, the Consortium for Nursing Education, which Dr. Tanner will tell you about, the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council Education Committee has developed nursing competencies. They are incorporating those in the new nursing program that's innovative and exciting that you're going to hear about, but we also need to put those into practice. We've done a number of publications, and we have a workforce study to be published shortly, and I already told you about a golf tournament, to raise awareness of nursing, the nursing shortage, and also to raise money. Other successes, and ONSC cannot claim these, but they are a result of the heightened awareness and the collaboration that's occurring in our state. There's the Providence Scholars Program. That's a remarkable program where a full-ride education at the University of Portland for 75 juniors and 75 seniors at the cost of $16 million over 2.5 years that Providence is putting toward that education. I think that's a national model, personally. They are also paying for 7 master's programs, the 7 students in the Clinical Nurse Leader Master's Program. That also brings me to the Clinical Nurse Leader Program. This is master's-prepared nurses prepared in a clinical nurse leadership role because we know that retention is huge and that we need experts at the bedside. Oops. OHSU and University of Portland have created those programs. And Oregon actually is one of the leading states in that initiative, so that's very exciting to be coming here. The Gray Matters program at Rogue Valley Medical Center is very creative. The Gray Matters is recently retired nurses going back for 4-hour shifts to mentor and support new nurses and to help out, and they do it for benefits only. They don't really want the pay, they need the benefits, and this is working for everyone, and it's highly successful, creative, and I think examples of the great things that are happening here. What's next? We need to maintain the focus on nursing as a profession and the image of nursing. There's still work to do in this regard. We want smart men and women choosing nursing. We need to focus on the practice environment, and Dr. Davidson is going to tell us about that. Still work to do on the education goals, as you already saw. We're getting there. But even with that, the data that we have from there, we have looked at the data, and the supply data is not all done. But even with doubling enrollment, we're not going to be where we need to be to solve this nursing shortage. We're still going to be about 15,000 nurses short. So we have to really work. Yes.
Yeah, Senator Martin.
A real number.
Yes.
Are you talking Oregon or nationally?
In Oregon.
15,000?
By 2025.
2025.
Okay, so that's very projectory.
Okay, so you don't know how many are we short today?
Oh, yeah, I do have those numbers, but I don't have them off the top of my head.
And the numbers that we have, there are two different ways to look at those numbers. We have position vacancies and then FTEs that are projected. So there's two different ways of looking at the numbers. But in any way that we have looked at these, using Department of Labor and federal numbers, also the HRSA numbers, that's about how it came out. I'll have to get that to you. I don't remember it off the top of my head.
Thank you.
This is why we're short, though. The gray side, and ignore the minus numbers there because I couldn't figure out how to block those out. The left side shows you Oregon nurses by age in 1996, and you can see most of them were in 40 to 49. This is, and on the right is 2004 data. We just got this from the study that we're doing. So you can see we're all getting older. And the good thing is, look how many more nurses are working at an older age group. But this is one of the reasons we're going to be short, and the other reason we're going to be short, one of the other reasons, is the data on the left is the 2000 data for the census. This is Oregon census information. And that's our age distribution, and you can see that there's more younger people than older people. But on the right-hand side, we flatten out in 2025, and there are as many old people as there are young people. And that's where the rubber hits the road, is that we have, unless we do more to get more nurses, and educating them in Oregon is not the only way we get them. Nurses come in from other places, the foreign nurses are coming in as well and taking the NCLEX. So there are other avenues, but that's primarily how we get them.
Thank you. Now, when we talk about nurses, we talk about a wide variety. What about the two-year program? That's your basic.
These are the data that I am presenting are all registered nurses. So these are associate degree and baccalaureate degree nurses. What was your question?
Oh, well, I guess my question, and we don't have to really get into this, is how many people just have the associate degree and are working with an associate's degree without having gone on to get the baccalaureate. Now, in order to advance in the profession, I guess, if you're going to become a nurse practitioner and all those other things, you need
baccalaureate degree,
yeah,
yes.
Absolutely. But to fill the basic shortage, the associate degree nurses would suffice in many cases.
That's right. Correct. So we are in complete partnership with the associate degree programs. I think correct me if I'm wrong, it's about 60% associate degree nurses in the state of Oregon and 40% baccalaureate.
Okay, OHSU only deals with the baccalaureate program, right?
OHSU is our, yes.
Yeah, okay. And
and graduate.
Okay, and then the various community colleges and the hospitals train the associate.
We have four baccalaureate programs in the state of Oregon. Oregon Health and Sciences University, University of Portland, Winfield College, and Walla Walla College at Portland Adventist. We have two new baccalaureate programs coming online, which are George Fox University and Concordia, and they will both start admitting students next year.
And I believe Paula Gruberg, I don't know what you are, dean of this nursing facility. She was saying that there's also work being done in the program where the two-year will blend right into the four-year.
That's the consortium, the Nursing Education Consortium that Dr. Tanner and Ms. Grubrub and Paula are going to talk about.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry, Ms. Moon. So this is why there's a problem. So now it's time to focus on retention. I think the educational, all of the work that has gone into increasing enrollment and reforming nursing education has been phenomenal, and I don't believe those folks are going to stop. They're going to continue working hard, but now we need to start focusing on retaining all those nurses that we do bring in to work in Oregon. or that we educate in Oregon. And has already alluded to earlier that transition from school to work is a prime time to start talking. Maybe we didn't talk about that here. The first couple years out of school are very vulnerable years for new nurses, so we would like to do mentorship programs and first-line leader development programs to keep nurses at the point of care, not only to keep them in facilities, but to keep them in nursing. Our retention of men and minority nurses, one of the ONLC's goals is culturally competent care, also recruitment and retention for hard-to-find sectors, as well as for men and minority nurses. We also know from previous studies that their satisfaction ratings with their profession are lower than white women. So we need to do something to retain those nurses so we have culturally competent workplaces also and practice environments. And then retention of all of us older nurses. There are a number of ways, I think, that can be done to accommodate the capacity. We have tremendous skill and experience in our nurses, and we need to capitalize on that. And these are some of the places that we can start working right now. If you look at the turnover rates, this is where we can start working on retention. And if you look at the range of turnover rate from 0 to 60 or 0 to 133%, we know where we need to start looking at preceptor programs, at leadership development of leaders, of the managers and charge nurses to keep nurses in those facilities. And we also have models. Somebody doesn't have a lot of turnover, so we already have models for how it's to be done. And some of those results from the conferences to magnetize the state of Oregon, to bring best practices to facilities here, we can start incorporating those. So this is, I think, where we need to be going as well. This shows that 55% of our nurses work in acute care settings. I think most people think of nurses in the hospital, but everyone will be affected by the nursing shortage because nurses are in every setting. So to summarize, we're making great progress, but there's still tremendous work to be done. Doubling enrollment isn't going to be enough, so we need to focus on retention. Maybe we need to triple enrollment. I don't know. Our educators will tell us where we need to go with that. And leadership is the key to all of that. And it's leadership at all levels. It's you and us. So thank you very much for this opportunity to tell you about the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council and the Oregon Center for Nursing.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell, very much. Any discussion? Questions? I'd like to call Dr. Louise Shores to the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm Louise Shores, Project Director for the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education. And after the agendas were printed, we decided that my colleagues, Dr. Chris Tanner, who is Professor at Oregon Health and Science University, and Paula DeBrood, who is Dean of Allied Health at Mount Hood, would make our presentation. They exemplify the collaborative process that we've been engaged in creating the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education and can speak from direct involvement throughout the process to the vision that we have and the goals that we're achieving in preparing for the future education of Oregon nurses. So I give you Dr. Tanner and Paula DeBrood. Yeah.
Thank you for giving us an opportunity to speak with you. I'm Chris Tanner, professor at Oregon Health and Sciences University, and we really appreciate your concern and interest about the shortage of qualified nurses. Paula Goodwood-Howe and I have been involved in the work on the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education for about 5 years now, beginning with our work, joint work on the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council, and these are all these acronyms and various groups collaborating to try to respond to this crisis that's looming on our horizon. I'd like to comment before we get into it that Dr. Campbell's presentation, I think, really highlights a lot of the issues in terms of the numbers of nurses that are needed and how we're able to respond. the numbers of enrollment that she mentioned and the increases in enrollment in large measure are not sustainable. While we've been able to increase enrollments in many of the programs, it's through partnerships with our health systems and other groups that have contributed a clinical faculty member so we can increase enrollment by 89 students. Or in the case of OHSU, where our health system said, let's increase bringing another cohort of students mid-year. So we brought in another 72 students mid-year with very limited funding in order to do that, but we won't be able to sustain that with the current situation. So the reason that the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education was born was to figure out a way that we could really increase enrollment dramatically without asking for dramatic increase in resources. Recognizing big limitations in our capacity, including an aging faculty, as we've already heard about, and the faculty shortage nationwide. It's not that we'll be able to bring in faculty because there aren't enough of us nationwide. Limited capacity for our clinical training. And as we mentioned,
Madam Chair and Committee, I'm Louise Shores, Project Director for the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education, and after the agendas were printed, we decided that my colleagues, Dr. Chris Tanner, who is Professor at Oregon Health and Science University, and Paula Gabrud, who is Dean of Allied Health at Mount Hood, would make our presentation. They exemplify the collaborative process that we've been engaged in creating the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education and can speak from direct involvement throughout the process to the vision that we have and the goals that we're achieving in preparing for the future education of Oregon nurses. So I give you Dr. Tanner and Paula Gabrud. Thank you.
Thank you for giving us an opportunity to speak with you. I'm Chris Tanner, professor at Oregon Health and Sciences University, and we really appreciate your concern and interest about the shortage of qualified nurses. Paula Gabrud Howe and I have been involved in the work on the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education for about 5 years now, beginning with our work, joint work on the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council, and these are all these acronyms and various groups collaborating to try to respond to this crisis that's looming on our horizon. I'd like to comment before we get into it that Dr. Campbell's presentation, I think, really highlights a lot of the issues in terms of the numbers of nurses that are needed and how we're able to respond. The numbers of enrollment that she mentioned and the increases in enrollment in large measure are not sustainable. While we've been able to increase enrollments in many of the programs, it's through partnerships with our health systems and other groups that have contributed a clinical faculty member so we can increase enrollment by 89 students. Or in the case of OHSU, where our health system said, let's increase bringing another cohort of students mid-year. So we brought in another 72 students mid-year with very limited funding in order to do that, but we won't be able to sustain that with the current situation. So the reason that the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education was born was to figure out a way that we could really increase enrollment dramatically without asking for dramatic increase in resources. Recognizing big limitations in our capacity, including an aging faculty, as we've already heard about, and the faculty shortage nationwide. It's not that we'll be able to bring in faculty because there aren't enough of us nationwide. limited capacity for clinical training. And as we mentioned over lunch, we have our commonplace for clinical education for our students is the hospital. And we know that in the hospital setting, people are very ill these days. Our turnover rate is very rapid in the hospitals. They stay in the hospital for about 3 days. Their collections of intensive care units, basically, it's not a place to begin educating neophyte students, which is why we think simulation is a good idea. So the issue about clinical training sites, faculty, resources that we can bring together to try to educate more nurses. So, Paula, can you tell them what we're doing about that?
Sure. Well, here's a map of Oregon. I'm sure you both recognize it, or you all recognize it. The red dots represent the consortium schools that are full partners. All of the nursing programs in Oregon participate in the consortium at some level. The full partnership means that the schools participating at that level will have common prerequisites, a common admission system, which means we will be able to collect better data as far as who's actually applying, and then the common curriculum with shared facilities, faculties, the simulation you saw. Our dream is to be able to take a simulation like that and send it off to, say, Treasure Valley in Eastern Oregon so that students would have an opportunity to participate in that kind of activity.
Tell me again how many community colleges are part of the
9 out of the 14, right,
are full partners.
Are full partners, and then the other 5 are participating at some level. And a couple of those of the 5 that are not full partners intend on becoming full partners when they have other things in place. This is a pretty work intensive endeavor by faculty to make this huge curriculum change. So as you can see, we're well represented throughout the state and have made huge efforts to include our rural schools so that they have better access. We really believe we're creating a national model. We know that people all over the country are looking at us. It's really an unprecedented collaboration between community colleges and university faculty with this seamless system of education that we're creating. And it's filtered down to the science faculty. I think Molly and Joe talked about the anatomy and physiology folks that are getting together so that those science prerequisites that are important for not just nursing but other health careers are also working together at a statewide level. We're also working to make our student services seamless, so students will be able to, in the consortium, will be able to move or be dual enrolled, and their student services will follow them wherever they go. So our partnerships include a network of the simulation facilities. So what you saw here, there are several of those throughout the state, and our goal is to be able to connect them so that students all over will have access to the simulations that are created. And then we'll also share the scenarios. The scenario that you saw happen today was programmed on a computer, and it took a couple faculty, you know, some time to do that. And rather than having to replicate that, our hope is to create a system so that faculty, say, in Bend would be able to just say, I know I need this scenario on somebody who's short of breath, and we'd be able to send it to them.
Shared brain power, what's left of it among us who are rapidly aging. But we believe that bringing together our minds to create more cost-effective teaching strategies is really, really important. And there are lots of details about filling out about how we're doing that. I want to comment also that at the heart of all of this work is a commitment to these shared competencies, and it's recognizing that, in fact, the nurse of tomorrow is going to need to know a whole lot more and be able to do a whole lot more than the nurse of today. We're talking about a nurse practicing in a high technology area with people who are very fragile, who are managing complex chronic illnesses, well beyond what we even see today, and having to do that in an environment where there aren't enough nurses. That's going to take a special kind of nurse leader to provide that kind of care. And the competencies that we've created and the programs that we're developing collaboratively between the community colleges and OHSU will prepare the nurse to be able to practice that environment. And I think that's really important understanding. We're really talking about a whole new education system in nursing toward a whole new set of competencies that are critical for this healthcare environment.
We also have some partners in, other kinds of partners in our efforts. This building is a really good example. This building was created through the developer of the shopping center, donated, gave us the seed money. We have some state money, some federal appropriations, and we have partners up the street. And it was created in order to double enrollment, and we're trying to create all those kinds of partners throughout the state. We're doing our best to cover costs regarding development, infrastructure, things like that.
So we've really moved along with tremendous accomplishments. First of all, probably the most significant, as I mentioned, are these agreed upon competencies. Let's move a little bit more quickly. And early on, the big accomplishment for nursing was that we all talked with each other. Any of you that know a history of nursing over the years, it was true that baccalaureate faculty and associate degree faculty had difficult relationships at best. And we've set all of that aside to say what's important is getting together to educate these future nurses. So we are focusing on nurses who are prepared to lead, direct, and provide evidence-based care to these vulnerable populations. And another miracle that's happened is that we've agreed on prerequisites, and any of you who've worked with any faculty, to get faculty from 10 different programs, the four campuses of OHSU and 9 community colleges, first to agree on prerequisites, so they have the same prerequisites. Students don't have to take twice the number of courses so they can apply to all the programs. They can take one set that's common. And next is an agreed upon curriculum, and we've reached a broad curriculum framework that will be standard across campuses while allowing for local variation as necessary to meet particular population needs. It allows for students to complete the associate degree and gives them eligibility to sit for the licensure exam, and then promotes seamless progression to the fourth year for the bachelor's degree completion in the student's home community. So students don't have to go travel outside of the community college locale to complete their bachelor's degree.
And when will that, like here, at the Bruning Center, when will that be in place where they could actually get their...
2005 is the year that they begin their prerequisites for a student coming straight through the 4 years. 2006 is the first year that they begin nursing courses. They'll be admitted to the nursing program statewide. They'll be able to graduate with an associate degree here at Mount Hood if they choose to in 2008, right. 2008, complete their bachelor's degree from OHSU by 2009. It's our other big accomplishment that we're continuing to work on is a lot of grant money. We've drawn about $1 million to us so far to promote faculty development and curriculum development. We have about $2.5 million of grants in review, and we'll continue to do that work. And this is simply to point out to you that we're really not asking the state to support the development of this. We're looking for external money, either from our private partners or from foundations or from the federal government, to support the development of this as it's being viewed as a national model. But we do need some things, and we recognize this is what everybody needs, some things. But we are looking for stable funding for the ongoing operations of existing programs, that really if we're going to be successful in educating more nurses, we have to have a stable sense that we can educate the number of nurses that we have, and that we need to continue efforts through these collaborations for higher education throughout the state.
We need the connectivity that between campuses that you heard about, the beginnings of that, but there's more that needs to be done, and we need support from the state for that. And we need the continued vision that's created the more, better, faster, whatever it's called now, so that students have access to continuing education, because it's you don't become a nurse and then you have it stop. So that vision of providing baccalaureate education throughout the state is important.
We'd be happy to answer any questions.
This makes me really proud to be a part of the nursing profession when I have seen nursing leaders like you doing what you are doing for the state of Oregon. I mean, truly, it is awesome, and I really think that what you are doing is the cutting edge. And thank you so much for sharing this.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for being here. Sue Davidson.
me a moment here to get plugged in. Okay. Good afternoon, Senators. It's a pleasure to be talking to you again. I saw you just briefly last week on 460. Let me get this into.
And for the record, just be sure to let us know
who I am.
Yeah,
first I got to get this slideshow going here. My name is Sue Davidson. I'm the Assistant Executive Director for Professional Services at Oregon Nurses Association. And once again, thank you for inviting me to participate in this conversation. If you conceptualize this day, what these preceding speakers have talked about is getting people into the nursing profession. And with others, I join others in thanking them for the work that they are doing. What I'm going to talk about is keeping nurses who are already in it. And so that's why my focus will be on the practice environment. My focus for the day will be to look at three elements of the practice environment. See if I can figure out how to make this thing work. The first one is I want to talk about practice processes that are safe and effective and efficient. And the example I'm going to use is the example of nurse staffing and what we are doing with respect to that. The second one is around equipment and technology, which reduces the workload intensity for the nurse. And the example I will give of this one is the work we're doing around safe patient handling. And the third example I'd like to give is one of collaboration. If it'll happen here, what's happening? There we go. Collaboration meaning that there is a degree of participative decision making that occurs between nurses at all levels within a facility. And the example that I will use is to talk about what are called professional nursing practice groups or committees on various units. Why am I going to talk about these? Well, the reason simply is that in the practice environment, you need to have, these are critical variables, the business of it being an efficient and an effective environment, the business of safe handling, and the business of collaboration are variables that are strongly linked to nurse retention. And when you take them all together, what they do is enable nurses to do what they love to do, which is nurse. So this first focus that I want to talk about is nurse staffing. I'm going to use some data here from a database that we have about nurse staffing in the state of Oregon. I can tell you that our database shows us that it doesn't matter which month of the year, there are nurses who report instances of unsafe staffing. Unsafe staffing happens every day of the week, not just the weekends. And the two most common units in the state who are reporting unsafe staffing to us are ICUs or CCUs or nursery neonatal intensive care units and medical surgical units. Those are the two most frequently reporting groups. And in the perspective of the staff nurse, this shows you that generally speaking, the reason why the nurse is reporting and saying it's not safe is because there aren't enough there, even though they may be scheduled. So that's the main reason. About 70% of those who report use that cause. A secondary cause is that the patient's acuity is very high, and even though everybody's there, the problem is that the needs of the patient are critical. I will give you a small example. In down the I-5, there's a fairly large hospital there which had a behavioral health care unit that closed. What that meant then was that when patients who have behavioral health issues are needing to be admitted, where do they go? Where they go is to the hospital, and they end up on medical surgical units. These are patients who have toxicity issues, who are having alcohol withdrawal, And when you already have insufficient numbers of nurses and you add patients with this acuity to that mix, the problem is it becomes a horrendous workload for nurses. And then the last cause, which is less in frequency, is where there's a mismatch. So there are too many nursing assistants and not enough registered nurses, or it can be the other way around. There can be other combinations of this particular cause. Now, in this slide, I'm trying to help you get a sense of what it is that contributes to what I call workload intensity, meaning the nurse has a workload. These numbers kind of help you see what happens. If you were just to look at what at the beginning and the end of a shift, every nurse keeps track of how many patients were there at the beginning and there at the end. And typically, the average across the state of those who have reported for the years 2000 to 2004, that number is about 18 or 19 at the beginning and 18 or 19 patients at the end of that shift. No problemo. However, the real deal is that they may have admitted, transferred in, transferred out, and discharged up to about 9 patients. That kind of turnover of patients brings with it a whole wad of nursing care that is added to the 19 that they had at the beginning and the 19 that they had at the end. That factor of turnover has not been one that has been staffed to. In other words, it's sort of suck it up, you can do it, but in fact, that's what's really contributing to the sense of fatigue and difficulty that nurses have in the clinical area. So what has ONA been doing? Well, we introduced, as you well know, through Senator Knoop and Mark Simmons in 2001, HB 2800, which is a nurse staffing bill. That bill went into effect in 2002, and the elements of the bill are that it requires that staff nurses participate in the development, the implementation, the monitoring, and evaluation of the staffing plan. In other words, it essentially forced a partnership between working nurses and those who typically create the staffing plan. It also added yearly random audits of 7% of the acute care facilities in the state. That has been in effect for 2 years now, and it is at about the equivalent of 5 facilities on a random basis each year. The other component of this bill is whistleblower protection for the nurse, who does raise the issue of unsafe staffing so that there cannot be recrimination. We are going forward with enhancements of the bill. The bill has been dropped, and amazingly, the number of the bill is HB 2800. I just learned that today from Martin. We are also doing continuing education about nurse staffing for staff nurses. It's one thing to be a manager. It's another to be participating in this. We've offered these classes across the state. We've developed some publications that are useful for nurses to learn about this. We have asked our nurses to come together around the definition of unsafe staffing so that our reporting is standardized. We have this reporting system that I've mentioned, and we are developing a process that links nurse staffing to unit-based committees so that they can deal with the problem on their unit or at the system level. These are not entities or processes that have been in place. So what's the outcome of all of this work on nurse staffing? Well, you can see across the year 2000 to 2003 that we did have a small reduction in the number of reports that were generated and sent to ONA. You need to recognize that ONA's database is available to any nurse in the state, but more typically it's our members who report to this database, and we represent about roughly 52, maybe 53% of the facilities in the state. However, a more dramatic change was seen in terms of no rest breaks and mandatory overtime. There has been a significant reduction in the amount of reported mandatory overtime. However, that is there are provisions that say you may not work more than 2 hours over an agreed-upon shift. So for an 8-hour shift, that's 10, or for someone on a 12-hour shift, that's 14 hours. And no more than 16 hours per 24. So there are still a percentage of reports of mandatory overtime, even though it's not supposed to be happening. The second focus I want to briefly talk about is that equipment and technology is intended to reduce workload. And the particular one I want to focus on is workload technology that helps reduce the frequency of musculoskeletal injury and disease. Here you see some statistics about the frequency with which people in healthcare sustain strains, sprains, and actual back injuries. Nurse-related back pain is now reported in the United States at about 47% among those who are practicing. What are the contributing factors? Well, part of it is that we've had a theory in nursing that the best way to move a patient is to move them manually, and in fact that has been proven not to be true. There are a number of ineffective traditional methods to address back injuries and how they are caused, and they don't work either. And there has been a lack of staff nurse participation in identifying what are the gaps in safety on our unit, decisions that have been made on the basis of no data, and finally equipment purchases that are done without the user's input. Recently, a representative from one of the vendor companies was visiting in the state and did a survey of a particular hospital, and in the basement he found well over $1.5 million of equipment that was in the basement rather than out on the clinical units where nurses could use it. So there's some gaps here in both. It looks like the equipment can be bought, but they're not where the nurses need it. So what we did was a number of things. The first thing was we became a member in the Oregon Coalition for Healthcare Ergonomics. This is comprised of labor, hospital association, long-term care, insurance carriers such as SAFE, and OSHA. And then what we have done is develop products and services for staff nurses. We have developed some educational materials, including a set of videos based on a project we did in-state with a facility. We've provided workshops. We've done unit-based training. We have done consultation to facilities on ergonomics and their safety committees. We have done some consultation with designers because nearly every hospital we visit has building plans that are near completion or at least in the planning phases. And we have also hired a certified professional nurse ergonomist to be a member of ONA staff. What this is helping us to do is to get a better picture of the details of what isn't working within the practice environment, and it is leading us to continue these safe handling workshops. We just completed one this past week at Tuolumne, and there were 45 people there, nurses, CTs, and health human resources folks who were in attendance at the workshop. The third focus is on collaboration, and what we mean by this is shared decision-making at the unit level that is significant, and shared decision-making at the organizational level, and then finally leadership that is open to participation of nurses. Here's an example of a question in a survey that we just recently did. Have you as an RN been consulted in a meaningful way about processes to create or improve your work environment? And you can see that there's relatively no difference between urban and rural hospitals, but the first two bars here are not at all or a little bit, and added together it comes out to be about 65-68%. In either place, nurses are only asked 40% of the time. That's not enough, and we believe that those numbers need to change. So our approach has been legislation. As I mentioned, we've gone back with some enhancements of 2800. We have some collaborative projects going to enhance unit-based practice committees, and we are working on teaching nurses to have enhanced decision-making skill through professional nursing care committees. So in summary, the three factors that I focused on today, of which there are more, but they are practice processes, equipment and technology, and collaboration at a number of levels. What these all do when they're working together is they enable nurses to do what they love to do, and that is be with the patient and nurse the patient. So these factors really create a practice environment that retains Oregon's nurses. Thank you very much for hearing my comments.
Thank you, Ms. Davidson. It is important, the nursing environment. is critical to be looked at so that we keep our nurses working. Thank you. I'd like to close the informational hearing. Any discussion? Yeah, no. Close the informational hearing. And so I'll do that. And then I did have a public hearing, and there were two people, but it really needs to be germane to healthcare workforce. So there were two people that signed up, Andrew Charter from Bi-Mart.
Chair Monis Anderson and committee members, I want to thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Andrew Charter. I'm Vice President of Pharmacy Operations for Bi-Mart and the President of the Oregon Pharmacy Association. And I just want to shift the discussion here for just a few minutes to the pharmacy workforce and where we're at in terms of pharmacists. There's some data there that's from 2000 to 2005. I have slightly different numbers from 1998 to 2004, but it all comes out about the same. An overview gives us the fact that the number of pharmacies in Oregon, the number of licensed pharmacies, has increased in the last 5 or 6 years by about 20-25%. At the same time, script volume filled in Oregon is increasing in the high teens. And the number of pharmacists licensed in the state of Oregon who live in the state of Oregon has grown at the same time about 8%. And I'm not going to go over why the number of pharmacies and the demand has increased. We all know why that is. We've seen the graphs already. It's about the demand for health care. But pharmacy has some unique pressures, and that's that if you look at that chart, we're graduating only 65 depending on the year, 40, 65 students that are staying in the state of Oregon. And if you look at the last couple of years, we've had as many as 160 pharmacists not renew their licenses, either leaving the workforce or leaving the state and not renewing their license. So we're not even graduating enough pharmacists every year to cover the pharmacists that are leaving the profession. And if I look at these numbers just for Bi-Mart, we operate 62 pharmacies, and right now 55 of those are in Oregon. And I'm looking for 12 full-time pharmacists, so that's one every six stores. And quite frankly, I'm in better shape than a lot of my competitors are that are building stores faster than they can staff them, quite frankly. And they're doing that because of consumer demand. Also, the number of pharmacies growth, it does not reflect the fact that, as you all know, a lot of my national competitors are open long hours, sometimes 24 hours, and that can...
This is the Senate Committee on Health Policy. Meeting date is Friday.
Some data there that's from 2000 to 2005. I have slightly different numbers from 1998 to 2004, but it all comes out about the same. An overview gives us the fact that the number of pharmacies in Oregon, the number of licensed pharmacies, has increased in the last 5 or 6 years by about 20-25%. At the same time, script volume filled in Oregon is increasing in the high teens. And the number of pharmacists licensed in the state of Oregon who live in the state of Oregon has grown at the same time about 8%.
And I'm not going to go over why the number of pharmacies and the demand has increased. We all know why that is. We've seen the graphs already. It's about the demand for health care. But pharmacy has some unique pressures, and that's that if you look at that chart, we're graduating only 65, depending on the year, 40, 65 students that are staying in the state of Oregon. And if you look at the last couple of years, we've had as many as 160 pharmacists not renew their licenses, either leaving the workforce or leaving the state and not renewing their license. So we're not even graduating enough pharmacists every year to cover the pharmacists that are leaving the profession. And if I look at these numbers just for Bi-Mart, we operate 62 pharmacies, and right now 55 of those are in Oregon, and I'm looking for 12 full-time pharmacists. So that's one every six stores. And quite frankly, I'm in better shape than a lot of my competitors are that are building stores faster than they can staff them, quite frankly. And they're doing that because of consumer demand. Also, the number of pharmacies growth, it does not reflect the fact that, as you all know, a lot of my national competitors are open long hours, sometimes 24 hours, and that can double the need of for pharmacists in that particular pharmacy. For me, it means that to fill those 12 spots right now, I've got to either ask pharmacists, like the nurses, to work overtime, which I'm not particularly fond of because I think anybody in healthcare ought to have plenty of time off and be recharged when they come back to work. Also, I have to use contract outside service pharmacies, and that's the same thing in nursing, and you pay about 1.5 times what you pay for the going rate of a pharmacist, and that just makes operating the pharmacy that much more expensive. And using outside service also decreases that continuity of care, and so does not having enough pharmacists because you have people going to different stores on their days off, and the patient can't always come in and see the same pharmacist. And we have a real issue in rural areas because many of the graduating class at the age they are want to live in Portland or Eugene or Salem. They don't want to go to Lakeview or Cay Falls or places like that because they make a decent living and they want to live in a rural area. And a lot of them are single and there's other reasons for that. So we struggle with the age of the pharmacists that are in our rural stores because the average age is much higher than in urban areas. And when they retire, it's going to be a real struggle to staff those stores, and that's going to really create an issue for access in the rural areas. The bottom line for me is that what I would like to see is more support for Oregon State University and the College of Pharmacy. When I graduated 15-some years ago, there was talk then of closing the College of Pharmacy to save money. The talk has come up again a few years ago, and obviously with the funding the university system is facing, the increases in tuition have gone up about 6 or 7 times more expensive to go to pharmacy school than when I went, and it's also an additional year because they graduate with a doctor in pharmacy now instead of just a BS. And all those things added together put a lot of pressure on the number of pharmacists that we have in the state to fill the vacancies that we have. Now, you know, when I talk about 12 holes, I realize compared to 15,000 nurses, it doesn't sound like much, but when you look at how many were graduating, the numbers are much easier for pharmacy because there's one College of Pharmacy. We have about 650 students apply. We accept about 90 of them, and about 60-some graduate and stay in the state of Oregon. It's not really looking good for the long term for pharmacy. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak, and I'll answer any questions if I can, and if I can't, I'll ask Tom to answer.
This is very interesting information that we need. Yes, Mr. Bercobian.
Thank you, Chair. And this may be kind of an odd question, but a while back I thought I read an article about seems like a lot of women either of Asian American background or maybe immigrants were going into pharmacy, so I started trying to notice now in my couple pharmacies that it seems to be that way. Is that a fact, and what's
it has been a fact in the past, and I don't have any specific numbers, but the current graduating class, I can tell you, is a lot of second career Oregonians and people from outside the state. And the number of students coming from outside the country has decreased substantially. And one of the challenges for those students that have stayed here that came from outside the country is pharmacy, unlike 30 years ago, 90% of your job is communication. And sometimes that's been a struggle for students that have come from other countries to be able to communicate. You have this huge technical knowledge. You got to put it in lay terms, and you got to communicate it to in a language that isn't your native language. And that has been a challenge in the past. Going in the future now, that isn't true about, there's certainly a diverse class, but not as many of them are from outside the country.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Thank you, Mr. Charter.
Thank you.
Yeah. And the last, Scott Forrester.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Scott Forrester, and I'll make this as germane as possible. Welcome to my neighborhood association. This is Northwest Gresham. It's a pleasure to have you here in Gresham. Come back sometime, will you? The issue that I'm bringing up here is my concern over a unionized healthcare workforce, and especially related to mental health. There was a proposal by a company for profit here on behalf of the Mental Health and Addiction Services Department to take some clients, as they call them, for the Psychiatric Security Review Board and place them in a facility right in the middle of my neighborhood. Now, we read about this in the newspaper, and since then, our neighborhood association has taken a stand opposing this every way legally. But the more I delved into this, is that it's a complex issue. People don't pay a lot of attention to mental health and the workers of those facilities, including the state hospital, and I've learned a lot. I'm not an MB, and neither is our association, but what I did find out related to workforce is that it's a unionized workforce, or at least a lot of them at the state hospital. So I called SEIU and talked to them, and they thought it was of great interest that there was a for-profit, non-union corporation basically privatizing a part of the function of the state hospital. I think that's relevant to workforce. If we are going to have these public-private partnerships, where is the discussion of unions, unions and generally higher wages, that tends to lead to a higher satisfaction and less transitional workforce. Those people have higher wages and can contribute better to the community. I would hate to think that a secure residential treatment facility for felons that have been convicted but because of insanity are in the mental health system would somehow escape or get diminished treatment because of a lack of union representation, because they're going to find the cheapest workers available. So this company has some union problems in the past, and I just wanted to bring it to your attention that I'd like to hold your horses on the state currently putting out this request for proposals to field out these folks. And I'll just make a few references and I'll be finished here. In reference to the report to the governor, the mental health task force that came out in September of last year, there was a presentation by DHS before the 2005 Ways and Means Committee, apparently very recently, and I got this on the internet. One of the issues about the state hospital, there's a master plan that's going to be happening. So before we deal with the workforce shortages there, mandatory overtime, and community-based fishing out or farming out these, privatizing these union jobs, let's wait for at least the master plan and a discussion between citizens, voters, and taxpayers like myself and representatives like you about whether we want to have a new state hospital to close the old one and have all community-based and have dozens of other mental health facilities. But it mentions in the presentation by DHS that they want to stabilize relationships between union and management. That obviously means the workers. Then the e-board in November of last year passed for 75 beds from the PSRB jurisdiction to be placed in the community. I guess that means my neighborhood. Just to show you, because of an overpopulation, what they call a census, Now, I have concerns about the quality of care, again, related to the workforce. And then lastly, it mentions here about the master plan, which I hope would have a unionized, well-qualified workforce for health care, mental health. It mentions the master planning process is going to review staffing levels, mandatory overtime, and vacancies, staff vacancies. Also, apparently, the Department of Corrections will get with the Oregon Mental Health and Addiction Services to potentially create a forensic institute. And I'd be curious about the folks that would be working there, which will take people from the Department of Corrections that have committed crimes but need mental health treatment. And that sounds like an interesting concept. So one last point here in the Governor's Mental Health Task Force. It mentions that the OMHAS and PSRB need to have a rolling three-year plan for build-out and operation of community facilities to serve individuals under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board and local mental health authorities like Multnomah County, must participate in planning to serve the needs of those persons who are under the jurisdiction of PSRB. And in closing, I'll just say that I think that involves yourselves as elected officials, folks here in Multnomah County, including Commissioner Lonnie Roberts of this area, and citizens like myself and my neighborhood association, so that there's the nexus between a lack of funding, the need for perhaps new taxes or creativity in finding the taxes we have, and then also having a qualified, well-paid, happy workforce that can provide these important things to our community and to the mental health clients. But this all is involved in the idea of, such as this, siting a facility right in our neighborhood where folks have to read it in the newspaper, and we go from knowing nothing about mental health and the workers in to, like, learning more than we ever wanted to know. I just wanted to kind of preface that and wrap it around the concept of workforce and a unionized workforce with high wages.
Thank you, Mr. Forrester. And we have been dealing with the psychiatric hospital. It is one of the albatrosses on our backs because it costs so much money to house mental health patients in a hospital. And we are working very hard to have many more community-based housing, because most of these patients that are put out in the community, if they are well managed and on medication, fit very well into our community. That's another issue and another topic for today, but thank you for raising that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was just the fact that the SEIU representative expressed concerns that by farming out these people, even though it's costly, that you would be jeopardizing union jobs, and the idea was this company right here in town, Telecare, is a for-profit non-union outfit.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. And there's no further testimony? And I do need to make one comment on House Bill 460. There is a fee issue. The Board of Nursing had brought up to us that certified nurse specialists will need to be charged a fee, usually. And we can handle that in the House when the bill gets over in the House. Anyway, thank you, everyone, for being here, and the meeting's adjourned.